Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Sunday Register for April 28th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dave Stutz, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Lisa Horsch. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays, obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and Dear Abby. The third hour continues with more sports and lighter news. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can help keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Sunday Register. In central Iowa today, showers and a heavier thunderstorm perhaps. A little bit later, winds southeast 10 to 20 miles per hour. A shower and thunderstorm early tonight, and then maybe a stray thunder shower. The high is anticipated to be 69 and a low of 47. Tomorrow, Monday, breezy with some sun, high 67, low 49. On Tuesday, strong afternoon thunderstorms, a high all the way up to 81 and a low of 55. And then on Wednesday, rain in the afternoon, high 73 and a low of 55. And a little rain in the afternoon on Thursday. Friday remains cloudy. And then Saturday, we're going to see a little bit of sunshine and some cloudiness. Let's take a look at the headlines from today's Sunday Register. Tornado outbreak batters Iowa. The town of Minden smashed for the second time in 50 years. Sioux City College okays a $3 million settlement. 13 Chilean students had alleged labor trafficking. And a centennial celebration. Ledges State Park is going to mark its 100th anniversary this year. And now let's turn to Lisa for our first article.
All right. Front page is all about the tornado outbreak that batters Iowa. The first big picture, it's taken on a farm, my guess, is outside of Minden. And it is just shows piles of rubble behind what looks like a small metal shed that might not even have a back wall to it anymore either. And then the smaller picture is actually from Pleasant Hill from Saturday, and it shows a house still standing, but the roof is a mess. And of course, there are trees and other kinds of rubble strewn across the front yard. You can't even see like the garage of the house at all. So, town of Minden smashed for a second time in 50 years. This is written by Jose Mendiola and Philip Sitter. Spring storms helping to quench Iowa's long drought came at a high cost this weekend, as multiple tornadoes swept across southwest, south, and central Iowa, destroying trees and homes. Especially hard hit was the Pottawatomie County hometown of Minden, where four people were injured and a few structures were left untouched by a Friday afternoon twister. The same town of 600, about 30 miles northeast of Omaha, had been devastated by a tornado in June of 1976. Other cities struck Friday in Iowa included Pleasant Hill in the Des Moines Metro, Creston in Union County, and Tingley and Redding just to the south of Ringgold County. The National Weather Service said damage also was reported in Jasper and Crawford counties, and WOWT-TV reported damage near Pacific Junction in far western Iowa. The Weather Service said surveys to determine the extent of the damage would take a few days. The Weather Service estimated that at least 10 tornadoes had touched down in central Iowa, with more along the state's western border. Across the Missouri River, numerous tornadoes were reported in the Omaha area, with the suburban cities of Elkhorn and Blair, Nebraska, suffering severe damage. The National Weather Service said the large storm that struck Elkhorn appeared to have originated north of Lincoln, Nebraska, reaching an area near the west Iowa town of Soldier, a distance of at least 100 miles before dissipating. KETV reported a tornado also hit the General Aviation Building at Epley Airfield, with people in the main terminal at Omaha's airport ushered to shelters before flights could resume. No deaths were reported in either Iowa or Nebraska. Heavy weather also was affecting Kansas, Colorado, and Wyoming. The Weather Service had forecast the severe storms well in advance and broadcast multiple warnings as they formed. Across Metro Des Moines on Friday, thousands of residents repeatedly took shelter as warning sirens and cell phone alerts blared throughout the evening. More potentially heavy weather was expected into Sunday. As of Saturday afternoon, a tornado watch was in effect for much of the region south of Des Moines, as was a flood watch in anticipation of more heavy rain. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on Friday evening declared a disaster for Pottawatomie County, making available grants of up to $5,000 for households with incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty level for home and car repairs, replacement of clothing and food, and temporary housing expenses. Outside of Mendon on Saturday, law enforcement officials blocked entry to the town as workers in neon green vests walked the streets, clearing the mess left by the tornado. Though the storm damaged about 120 structures and left residents displaced, two Red Cross shelters opened to serve them. Had proven unnecessary, Pottawatomie County Emergency Management Agency officials said, as most storm victims found shelter with family and friends. Though four people in town were hurt, officials said three had been released from hospitals by Saturday afternoon, and the fourth was listed in stable condition. Austin Ehlers, a firefighter in Persia, a city about 15 minutes from Mendon, said the tornado demolished his grandfather's home. He lives just outside of Mendon, right in the path where the tornado took, Ehler said. After we cleared everything in Persia, we hopped into trucks and went to Mendon and helped. I found out my grandpa's house was completely gone, and he's basically lost everything. Ehler's family was reeling from the loss. This morning, it was just trying to figure out where you start with something this bad, he said. You just look at it, and you don't even know where to start. We got to make sure everyone is safe, get a good game plan, and worry about everything else after that. Fortunately, he said his grandfather was uninjured. He told me he just got into the basement and was getting ready to shut the door when all of his windows shattered and glass was hitting him in the back. He said it was close, real close. His account echoed those of people who survived the tornado that hit the town nearly 50 years ago. The Des Moines Register reported that when the 1976 tornado touched down, many residents were at a town carnival and sought refuge in a dance hall. The building collapsed, but none of those inside were hurt. Likewise, people who huddled inside the town tap escaped unharmed, despite the building losing its roof. WOWT reported the tornado that hit Mendon on Friday had been on the ground for nearly 40 miles, leaving a string of other damage along the way. Around 9 p.m. Saturday, another tornado touched down just west of Pleasant Hill. Fire Chief Jamie Jayavong said 20 homes were damaged and 18 left uninhabitable, and one person suffered non-life-threatening injuries. Polk County officials asked for monetary donations to the Polk County and Greater Des Moines Community Foundation Disaster Recovery Fund at desmoinesfoundation.org/nonprofitresources/disaster-recovery-fund. In Creston, the storm damaged portions of the roof as well as windows, and the main entrance of the Homestead Assisted Living Facility on the west side of town. A residence also was damaged. U.S. Representative Zach Nunn, whose district includes Creston, embarked for southern Iowa on Saturday to meet with officials and residents in the area. Iowa just emerged from a horrible event that occurred in many of our communities last night. In fact, we're headed down to Union County next to help take care of Creston and the communities that were impacted by horrible storms and tornadoes that ravaged the state of Iowa, he said at a campaign event Saturday morning. Our prayers not only are with Mendon, but those communities in Nebraska where we've flown flight operations out of. They're just decimated. And so this morning, as we think about what we need to do, it should always be about what we do can help these communities in need. There was no official ratings of the storm's strength on Saturday, but Brooke Hagenhoff, a National Weather Service meteorologist, said the system had been more severe than one that struck Iowa on April 16th. That system left scattered damage to structures, including three agricultural buildings in northern Dallas County. Chris Franks, a Weather Service meteorologist based in Nebraska, said roughly three tornadoes originated in Omaha and traveled into Iowa. Right now, it's pretty good to estimate that three tornadoes that came from Nebraska or very near the Iowa-Nebraska line and then crossed into Iowa, Frank said. I will caveat that the damage surveys are still very much ongoing. In fact, there's a lot of damage to survey.
Thank you, Lisa. And now let's take a look at what happened in Pleasant Hill last night. Friday storms hurt one, damages several homes. This story was submitted by Philip Setter of the Des Moines Register. A tree limb slammed through a bedroom window and pierced the exterior wall of a Pleasant Hill home on Friday, showering glass and twigs, the result of a fast-moving tornado that tore through several blocks. Rosie Ostrand was inside her Birch Boulevard residence when the storm swept, but fortunately was not in the bedroom. Outside, a trampoline was wrapped around a standing tree limb, and a street sign was blown over. Ostrand, who says she's lived in her Pleasant Hill home for more than 50 years, said she's experienced other tornadoes, but I've never had this much damage. Friday's tornado touched down just west of Pleasant Hill around 9 p.m., sweeping across town, injuring one and damaging nearly 20 homes. Pleasant Hill Fire Department Chief Jamie Exvon told reporters at an 11 a.m. news conference on Saturday that the injury was not life-threatening, though the 18 damaged homes were no longer inhabitable. The tornado is believed to have touched down near the intersection of Park Ridge Avenue and East Oakwood Drive and headed northeast, toppling trees and power lines along the way. Exvon said storm damage has been reported as far east as Northeast 80th Street. The fire chief did not know how strong the tornado was, though it felt several other homes with moderate or minor damage. She indicated that more damage reports could come in as recovery continues. None of the displaced residents needed emergency shelter. On Burr Oak Boulevard, resident Matt Flagg said he had been at a concert at Wells Fargo Arena with one of his children when the storm hit. Flagg returned home to find, among other damage, a large gash and a separate large hole in the side of his garage. His garage door was partly blown out toward the driveway. The derecho was comparable, but I've never had anything blow through the side of my house, Flagg said. Family and friends were around to help clean up. Along the block, there were cars caked with insulation and piles of shingles and lumber waiting to be cleared. One house appeared to have most of its roof missing. Sounds of sawing and an aroma of freshly cut lumber and tree sap filled the Pleasant Hill air Saturday morning. A group of volunteers representing the United Cajun Navy nonprofit worked to clear Ostrand's yard and others along her block using skid steer loaders to scoop up trees that had been cut with chainsaws. Altoona resident Aubrey Bailey and Colby Cook were a few of the United Cajun Navy volunteers who helped with recovery efforts. Cook owns a landscaping service, Cook Landscapes and Dirt Works, and brought the heavy equipment. This is Iowa, Bailey said. We're all coming together. At the height of the storm, Catherine Kunert of Midwestern Energy said more than 10,000 customers in the metro were without power. Kunert said 390 or so customers still without power are expected to have service restored around 6 p.m. Given the extensive number of downed power lines and debris in Pleasant Hill, the fire chief encouraged residents to stay out of the area. The chief said people had come from as far away as Granger to assist Pleasant Hill. We needed the resources to check houses, she said. She did not yet know if school would be held on Monday in Pleasant Hill. The Polk County Emergency Management Agency has been out much of Saturday assessing the damage and coordinating resources for residents in need. Polk County officials are organizing a call for volunteer help in Pleasant Hill. Authorities say monetary donations can be sent to the Polk County and Greater Des Moines Community Foundation Disaster Recovery Fund. We are saddened by the widespread damage caused by the tornadoes and storms in Pleasant Hill and across Polk County, Polk County Board Chair Angela Connolly said in a press release. Our primary focus right now is on ensuring the safety and well-being of all of our residents. We are working closely with local first responders, utility crews, and volunteer organizations to provide assistance and support to those impacted by this disaster. Lisa?
Now we'll take a look at Metro and Iowa section. On the front page, Centennial Celebration, Ledger State Park to mark 100th anniversary in 2024. This is written by Rana Faborg for the Ames Tribune. And the picture accompanying this shows about a half a dozen children in a creek, and the title says, Lyra Earhart from the Wild and Free Homeschool Community in Des Moines tries to catch fish while playing in the water on June 17th, 2021 at Ledger State Park in Boone County. And it is an action shot. There, she has splashed. There's water all over her, and she has a net in her hand aiming toward those fish. Ledger State Park has been rock solid for 100 years. That's the tagline on the t-shirts being sold at the park concession stand near the campground entrance commemorating its centennial. Ledger State Park in rural Boone County is named for the sandstone ledges that tower above the Des Moines River. It has been a popular spot for hikers, picnickers, and campers for several decades. The park boasts 4 miles of trails and historic structures constructed by the Civilian Conservation Corps during the New Deal era in the 1930s. Dedicated on November 9, 1924, Ledger State Park is located a few miles south of Boone. A number of celebrations and educational events will mark the 100th anniversary, with many still yet to be announced. The events are kind of like pop-up activities, said Rick Held, president of Friends of the Ledges, an organization that advocates for the park. The 100th anniversary events will be announced on the group's Facebook pages, Friends of the Ledges. A grand celebration will take place on September 28th to honor the 100th anniversary of the Ledges, coinciding with the National Public Lands Day. We want to give back to the community with a celebration at the Ledges, Held said. The day will begin with Friends of the Ledges' annual pancake breakfast, followed by a bags tournament. Many free activities will be offered throughout the day, including guided trail hikes, a professional magician, face painting, several carnival games, and a jump house. The clown Silly Sally will be on hand, making balloon animals and other shapes. 5 bands will grace 2 stages throughout the evening and afternoon, one in the campground and one near Oakwood Shelter. Performers include the Weary Ramblers, Lincoln Highway, Boonshine, Rural Route, and Justin Elliott and Aaron Eli. Bingo will be played at the Carl Fritz Henning Shelter for a small fee. A handful of food trucks will be on hand to provide meals, snacks, and beverages. The event will be of relatively low cost for visitors, Held said. The food trucks and bingo are the only expenses people might have. He said otherwise, everything is free of charge. Ledger State Park will be rededicated on November 9th, exactly 100 years after its initial dedication. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources is collaborating with Friends of the Ledges to plan the event. Additional details are not yet available. The celebration should have statewide appeal, joining one other park celebrating its centennial. There are only 2 parks in the state of Iowa having a 100th year celebration this year, Held said. The Ledges, and the other one is Pilot Knob up in Forest City.
Thank you, Lisa. The headline for this article reads, University Leaders Report to the Regents on DEI. And of course, DEI is an acronym for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Brooklyn Drazy of the Iowa Capital Dispatch submitted this story. Presidents of the state's public universities told the Iowa Board of Regents on Thursday they are eliminating departments and positions related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and looking to support students on a more individualized basis. Iowa State University, University of Iowa, and University of Northern Iowa have been working since the fall to adopt board directives relating to diversity, equity, and inclusion. That includes eliminating any, quote, unnecessary, end quote, DEI offices and positions, ensuring all services are open to all students on campus, and exploring ways to encourage diversity of thought and perspective. The presidents of each institution gave updates to the board on their progress towards completing the directives, including future actions to ensure compliance. However, Regent David Barker pointed out that some of these changes might be moot with the signing of legislation by Governor Kim Reynolds. U of I President Barbara Wilson told the board the university must foster a sense of belonging and provide a free environment for people to speak their minds. While this may seem difficult to pull off, she said, the two principles can coexist if university staff, faculty, and leaders work together to not lean too hard in one direction at the expense of the other. I think this is an opportunity for us as we think about what we're supposed to be doing at a university, Wilson said. We are supposed to be bringing students from all backgrounds, all walks of life, together and help them coexist and work together, not avoid each other, when they encounter differences. The University of Iowa's 20-member task force met with several stakeholder groups on campus throughout the past 4 months in order to craft recommendations relating to the DEI directives, Wilson said, and conducted a survey in order to receive more feedback. The university is almost finished reworking the university's central DEI office, Wilson said. The office will shift to 2 departments under the renamed Division of Access, Opportunity, and Diversity, handling accreditation requirements and compliance with state and federal laws. 5 open positions will be eliminated, opening up around $360,000 in salaries and benefits to go to student success initiatives. Most, if not all, of the 43 employees with DEI in their titles are necessary for accreditation or compliance, the Wilson said. But the University of Iowa is working to review each one. Review of the college's general education courses is also nearly complete, and the diversity and inclusion general education requirement will be renamed to Understanding Cultural Perspectives. The University of Iowa has completed board directives to prohibit the requirement for anyone on campus to share their pronouns, with the university adding a statement to that effect to all syllabi. A performance evaluation metric for employee evaluations was also changed from asking someone about their engagement relating to diversity, equity, and inclusion to their participation in activities that foster a welcoming and respectful environment. The task force also reviewed recruiting practices for faculty and staff and updated resources and advertising areas in order to try and reach a more intellectually diverse hiring pool. In order to ensure that everyone knows that all events are open to all, which Wilson said the UI was already doing, a policy has been added to the university's code that states all student groups and other university organizations must include a statement that whatever event they are holding is open to everyone. After the Board of Regents directed the universities to explore options for expanding education and research into civic education and free speech, Wilson said staff at the UI developed a pilot project that will be introduced to resident halls to teach students skills in communication and working with people who differ from them. led by resident assistants who will receive training from the university. The project will begin the upcoming fall semester with some residence hall floors receiving the education and others not, in order to measure outcomes, Wilson said. A first-year seminar will also be available for new students. Wilson said there were a few things she and others at the University of Iowa have learned throughout this process, including the necessity of gathering metrics on programs to measure their success and just how important it is that the college and others like it, quote, foster cultural and global competency, end quote. The university needs to teach students every day about how to work with each other, even if they have differences, and to instill in them the will to stick around when things get tough. Iowa State University President Wendy Winterstein said that in order to comply with the directives from the Board of Regents, the university will close its Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion office in July. Two filled and three open positions will be eliminated with this closure, and the impacted staff will receive a 90-day notice of their termination. The office closure will leave behind $789,000 in salaries and benefits, Winterstein said, which has been allocated to university priorities. Like the University of Iowa, Winterstein said Iowa State will place a statement on all syllabi that no one be required to disclose their pronouns, and digital and promotional materials for programs will convey that they are open to all students. After review of DEI positions in university departments, Winterstein said there are a number of units within the university's colleges and division for student affairs that are critical for accreditation and support for students and staff. The work under this directive is nearly complete, she said, with updates being made where needed. A review of the university's diversity, equity, and inclusion general education category has led to it being renamed U.S. Cultures and Communication. The university has also broadened its advertising efforts for open positions in order to reach different groups. Winterstein said advertisements for its provost position went into the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. A working group is also developing proposals for initiatives relating to free speech and civic education in the university's College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, Winterstein said. Winterstein said the task force conducted its work in meeting the board's directives within the context of a quote from early ISU Board of Trustees President Benjamin Gu, and Mr. Gu's last name is spelled G-U-E. Everyone would be welcome regarding of race, gender, or socioeconomic status. University of Northern Iowa developed two groups to focus on the different directives, the DEI Advisory Task Force and Civic Education at UNI Task Force. President Mark Nook said the groups and the administration took three directives as a chance to reimagine how the university supports its students and employees, and found that in order to meet them, current structures, communication, and other parts of forming the UNI community must change. The university will reorganize the division of student life under the directives, including eliminating the Diversity, Inclusion, and Social Justice Office and creating new positions to offer direct-to-student services to all UNI students, Nook said. More services will go to the Office of Student Involvement and Office of the Dean of Students to offer more supports to student organizations, programming, and individual student needs. UNI will also eliminate the position of Chief Diversity Officer, Nook said, and create an outreach position in the university's Center for Urban Education. Five positions in the Academic Affairs Office will be realigned to offer more students access to resources for enrollment, academic needs, and graduation preparedness. Barker said during the meeting that since the board knew nothing of the university's progress in meeting the directives between November and April, no one was able to convey information to the Iowa legislature. He believed this is why legislation restricting DEI offices and spending at the state universities was passed. Senate File 2435 would, using what Barker called a broader definition of DEI, bar universities from starting, maintaining, or funding DEI offices or positions unless required by law or for accreditation. The Attorney General will handle complaints filed against universities claiming violations. This bill, if signed into law, would make many of the Board of Regents' directives irrelevant, Barker said. He suggested that the board and universities work together to become compliant under the new rules. Regent Robert Kramer said he believed what they've been doing under the directives is now moot, and expressed disappointment at the legislation being passed without lawmakers knowing what the regents know now. Lisa?
Sioux City College okays $3 million settlement. 13 Chilean students had alleged labor trafficking. This is written by William Morris for the Des Moines Register. Western Iowa Tech Community College will pay $3 million to 13 Chilean students who accused the Sioux City institution of labor trafficking. The college confirmed in a statement that the settlement, first reported by Siouxland Proud, had received approval from its board on Wednesday. The agreement came in one of two lawsuits filed by foreign students from Brazil and Chile. They alleged they were recruited to travel to Iowa for what they thought would be a two-year degree program in robotics and culinary arts, including free tuition, room and board, supported by internships with local companies. Instead, they alleged they were placed in jobs on the line at a dog food plant and other factories, deprived of food and forced to work under threats of deportation. The students traveled to Iowa under J-1 exchange visas overseen by the U.S. State Department, which in 2019 found multiple issues with the college's implementation of the program and ordered it to place students in more suitable internships. The school canceled the program and sent the students home in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. The college in statements, including the one Wednesday, and court filings, has acknowledged missteps with the program but denied allegations that the students were intentionally misled or exploited. In its statement, it said the decision to settle was made for financial reasons and not as an admission of wrongdoing. We appreciate the board's decisive action and are pleased to have this matter resolved. Terry Morrell, president of Western Iowa Tech, said in the statement, "The college's enrollment and finances are strong, and we remain focused on providing an enriching educational experience for all of WITCC students. This matter will not impact or influence our programs or future plans." Attorney Ben Bergman, representing the former students, said they have reached a separate confidential settlement with Royal Canin USA, which operated one of the factories where they were placed. Additional claims remain pending against Turpak Foods, another manufacturer, and a staffing agency, Premier Services Incorporated. Bergman declined to comment further. Sarah J. Millsap, an attorney for Premier Services, said the company was not involved in the settlement and strongly denies any allegations of wrongdoing, adding that it intends to continue its vigorous defense against these spurious claims. The Des Moines Register has reached out to attorneys for Royal Canin and Turpak, but for comment. The second lawsuit involving 9 students also brings claims against the college, Royal Canin, Turpak, and Premier, and is set for trial in May of 2025. The college and attorney Roxanne Conlon, representing those plaintiffs, confirmed that they had not settled their case. The outcome of that lawsuit is unrelated to this decision, the college said in its statements.
The Des Moines Register will soon turn 175 years old. Is your business over a century old? Well, the Register wants to hear from you. This story was submitted by Bill Steeden of the Des Moines Register. Des Moines was not officially a city yet when Barlow Granger set up his printing press in a disused barracks of the fort, around which the settlement was sprouting at the confluence of the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers. It was a July 26, 1849, 175 years ago this summer, when the inaugural edition of the Iowa Star reached its first readers in the town of about 500 persons, known then as Fort Des Moines. Another 2 years would pass before the city of Des Moines was incorporated, and 8 before it became Iowa's capital. The Des Moines Register will recount its origins and historical highlights in coverage to be published online and in print as part of a July celebration of its 175th anniversary. But it's just one of the stories of Des Moines that the community's oldest news source intends to tell. As the Star grew, changed hands, and eventually became the Des Moines Register, other businesses were forming that came to compromise the economic engine of what is now Iowa's largest metropolis. Hoyt Sherman, who arrived in town the same year as the Star began publishing, would join other early residents to found the Equitable of Iowa Insurance Company, the first issuer west of the Mississippi. It was the starting point of the financial services sector that is today a leading contributor to Des Moines' metro economy. Long at the helm of the Equitable was F.M. Hubbell, who also assembled a real estate empire that continues under his descendants' leadership and whose estate, Terrace Hill, is now the governor's mansion. Another early financier, Edward Temple, founded the Bankers Life Company, which today is the worldwide principal financial group and still headquartered in Des Moines. The Register was not the only publisher to rise with the city, starting with successful farmer. Meredith Corporation grew into one of the largest magazine publishers in the world. In the same era, the Wallace family began to rise to business and political prominence with the founding of another farm magazine, Wallace's Farmer. The third in a line of Henry Wallace's went on to serve as U.S. Vice President and founded the Pioneer Hybrid Seed Company, which now is part of Corteva AgriScience, and its sprawling research campus is in Johnston, Iowa. Also in the 1890s, the Iowa Bystander newspaper was established to serve Des Moines' African-American community, and in 50 years under the guidance of publisher James B. Morris, it became a leading voice for civil rights in Iowa. Established at Iowa State University more than a century ago, radio station WOI is the flagship of Iowa Public Radio, while a sister TV station became the first to serve central Iowa and today is part of the ABC network. Des Moines TV stations WHO and KCCI, the latter initially established by the Register's then sister company, Cowles Communications, soon joined. Lisa?
And now we will head back to the front page section of the Des Moines Register. From the editor, Carol Hunter, comes Book Traces Caitlin Clark's Basketball Journey in Iowa. If you became hooked on watching the University of Iowa women's basketball team and Caitlin Clark's otherworldly talents, we've got a treat for you. The Des Moines Register and the Iowa City Press Citizen are publishing a 160-page hardcover book, Unmatched, Caitlin Clark's remarkable journey from her Iowa high school career to breaking collegiate records and captivating the nation. The Des Moines Register and Press Citizen sports writers Matt Bain, Dargan Southard, and Chad Leistikow have covered Clark since her teen years at Dowling Catholic High School in West Des Moines. The book prints the best of that coverage and showcases more than 100 photos. Even the early coverage and photos of Clark with her familiar ponytail, but younger and thinner, is prescient about how skilled she was becoming and her potential to do great things on the basketball court. and Clark was never shy about declaring her ambitions. For a January 2020 article, after she had committed to the University of Iowa, Bain asked her what she wanted from her college career. Her response in the third paragraph was, to win a national championship. Clark matter-of-factly told the Register last Tuesday she'd been asked what color the sky is or what she had asked for breakfast. I remember seeing that quote at the time and inwardly gasping, admiring the youthful ambition and sky-high dreams, but reading it with an adult's awareness of the degree of difficulty involved and the hard knocks that life can deliver. Later in the story, Bain wrote, a recruit like Clark can elevate a program like Iowa and make a championship feel more like more of a tangible, reasonable, rational, realistic possibility. Fans had the privilege of watching Clark's ambition and the relentless work ethic push the Iowa team toward, for the rest of us, unimagined heights. Register sports editor James Kramers did the heavy lifting on pulling together the text and photos for the book. I helped a bit at the end with proofing the pages, and I'm proud of the book. It provides a fun trip down memory lane for Iowa women's basketball fans, old and new. It's available by pre-order at caitlin.pictoriabook.com for $31.95, which is 20% off plus tax and shipping. That offer expires May 12th, and the books ship May 17th. The Register will donate a portion of the proceeds to the Caitlin Clark Foundation. And we're celebrating our anniversary, too, along with other companies, as Dave just read in the previous article. July 26, 1849, marked publication of the first edition of the Iowa Star, a predecessor to the Des Moines Register, and we're planning a special coverage this July to mark our 175th anniversary. You'll hear much more about the planned coverage in coming months, but we're getting started now on one aspect. Throughout our history, we've told the stories of Iowa and Iowans. In that tradition, as part of our anniversary celebration, we want to share stories of other longtime Iowa businesses. We're asking Iowa companies that were founded in 1924 or earlier and continue to maintain a brick-and-mortar presence in the state to provide information about their businesses by filling out an online form at DesMoinesRegister.com/oldestbusinesses. We'll compile a listing online and we'll spotlight a handful of those businesses in print this July. And finally, helping Iowans through good journalism in February, a Lee Rude Register's Watchdog column published online and on the front page of the Sunday Register reported that Iowans who were sexually abused by Boy Scout leaders might get less money as part of a nationwide settlement because of Iowa's restrictive statute of limitations for filing civil claims regarding childhood sex abuse. The settlement uses a mix of factors to determine payment amounts and penalizes states with civil statutes of limitations that restrict who can file, Rude reported. Iowa's statute of limitations generally requires victims to file civil cases in district courts by age 19, the lowest age set by any state, she wrote. Victims can also file suits within 3 years of when they made the connection between their abuse and their injuries. On April 19th, just hours before a key deadline in the national settlement litigation, Governor Kim Reynolds signed a narrowly tailored, fast-tracked bill that removes the civil statute of limitations only for those Iowa survivors of sexual abuse who were part of the Boy Scout settlement, qualifying them for higher payments. That legislation had stalled until Lee wrote about the issue, and soon other media began covering the story too. Peterson, a longtime advocate for eliminating the civil statute of limitations on childhood sexual abuse, praised the media's role in bringing attention to the predicament of Iowans abused by Boy Scout leaders in their youth. Today's victory is a great example of how the legislature can help people when we work together for justice and when the media shines a light on an important issue, Peterson said. That's what Lee does in her Reader's Watchdog column week in and week out, pressing for answers and accountability on Iowans' behalf. And again, that comes from the Register's executive editor, Carol Hunter.
Thank you, Lisa. The headline of the next article reads, Urbandale Food Pantry plans to move to a larger location. The city to help pay for the purchase and renovation. Philip Sitter of the Des Moines Register submitted this story. Overflowing with hungry families and struggling to find enough space to store food, the Urbandale Food Pantry plans to acquire a new building to meet the community's needs. It's getting help from the city as it prepares for the purchase and implements a multi-year plan to assess issues, including food insecurity and access to transportation and affordable housing. Patty Sneddon-Kissling, the pantry's executive director, said the increasing needs for assistance is a stark reminder that many people face the daily struggle of putting food on the table. Urbandale City Council on April 16th approved a development agreement with the pantry for its purchase and renovation of the building, described as its new principal place of business at 7901 Douglas Avenue. The about 7,200 square foot two-story brick veneer office building at the new location would be more than twice as big as the space Sneddon-Kissling said the pantry currently occupies at the nearby Cedar Ridge Shopping Center at 7611 Douglas Avenue. And site plans for the new location, approved April 22nd by the Urbandale Planning and Zoning Commission, call for adding on more than 1,500 square feet of space in a vacant area behind the building. We're at capacity where we're currently at, Sneddon-Kissling said. She said the pantry is constantly having logistical conversations of where to put the 100,000 pounds of food delivered to it every month as it accommodates needs that amounted to 1.4 million pounds last year. And it isn't just the food. The Des Moines Register observed on an evening in mid-April that people were waiting in line out the door for client intake services. Sneddon-Kissling said, "It's that way every day, no matter the weather." The development agreement with the city offers the food pantry $470,000 in capital project funds to help buy the new property so long as it enters into a purchase contract before May 1, closes the sale before May 15th. The property was valued at $495,000 in 2023, according to Polk County real estate records, $167,000 for the building and $328,000 for the more than 38,700 square foot lot. The property was last sold in 2019 to its current owner, BMKAR LLC, for $410,000. The development agreement would require the pantry for 20 years to set aside space in its new home, including 77% of the second floor, for other organizations that deliver services identified in the city's human services plan. The city and the food pantry will mutually agree on who the other tenants will be, but the plan's human services strategic plan, which the city council also approved April 16th, identifies needs in the community, including increasing access to food assistance, improving the quality, ridership, and available routes of public transportation, increase the supply of affordable housing, expand English language learning support programs, and bolstering the affordability and availability of child care and youth development programs. Addressing food insecurity and housing affordability are the city's top priorities, according to the plan. For the food pantry's new office, Sneddon-Kissling said, "As we finalize a new location and evaluate renovation needs, we will determine the precise financial resources required. We urge our community to join us in this crucial effort, ensuring that everyone has access to essential food support." She added that a feasibility study confirmed what we've known all along, that a new location is not just a dream, but a tangible and financially viable opportunity. People can donate money to support the food pantry at secure.give-life.com Lively, and that's L-I-V-E-L-Y, .org. And then follow that with a /donate/ Urbandale-food-pantry. And can also watch for a future capital fundraising campaign, Sneddon Kissling said. Information about other donation and volunteer opportunities is available at urbandalefoodpantry.org.
Fired UIHC doctor, and UIHC is University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, challenges suspension of license. Petition asks court to review Iowa Board of Medicine's actions. This is written by Clark Kaufman for the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A fired University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics resident is going to court to challenge the suspension of his medical license. In January, the Iowa Board of Medicine announced it had issued an emergency order immediately suspending the license of Dr. Gabriel Hernandez Roman, age 33, formerly of Iowa City. On February 15th, the board issued an order imposing a $7,500 civil penalty against Hernandez Roman and suspended his Iowa medical license indefinitely. The board alleged Hernandez Roman had used his status as a physician to gain access to private information about individuals with whom he engaged in romantic and sexual relationships. Hernandez Roman is now challenging the suspension by taking the matter to Polk County District Court, where his attorneys have filed a petition seeking judicial review of the board's actions. In the petition, Hernandez Roman doesn't directly address the most serious allegations against him, but argues the board has imposed sanctions against him for violation of an internal educational dress code that don't support findings of professional incompetency, unethical conduct, and the harmful practice of medicine. In his petition, Hernandez Roman also notes that the board had previously considered a complaint against him involving another internal non-standardized rule of the University of Iowa regarding moonlighting and had dismissed it without a hearing. Now, Hernandez Roman alleges the board believes the same exact complaint is an indicator of professional incompetence. The petition claims the Board of Medicine has punished Hernandez Roman for reasons wholly unrelated to statewide standard of medical care and instead upon alleged violations of internal policies of the University of Iowa. Hernandez Roman is asking the court to review the matter and enter an order reversing the Board of Medicine's decision. In response, attorneys for the state have denied any wrongdoing and indicated the board will be filing a more detailed answer to Hernandez Roman's claims at a later date. Board records indicate that in early of 2023, UIHC staff became aware of allegations that Hernandez Roman had violated patient privacy regulations by gaining unauthorized access to the medical records of a person with whom he had a romantic relationship. It was alleged that when Hernandez Roman realized the woman was aware he had accessed her medical records, he went to her home and threatened that if she ended his career, he would end her. A hospital investigation revealed that Hernandez Roman had accessed the records of two individuals who were not his patients. One of those patients was a woman who alleged that when she was dating Hernandez Roman, he had looked up her medical records and then began reading them to her while commenting that certain doctors had said interesting things about her, according to board records. When asked to explain his actions, Hernandez Roman allegedly told his superiors that he had accessed the woman's records out of fear that she was having a psychotic breakdown, adding that girls sometimes say things they do not mean, board records state. Hernandez Roman allegedly admitted that he also had a romantic relationship with the second woman whose records he had accessed. In that case, he allegedly explained that he had pulled her medical records to check lab results for any sexually transmitted diseases, telling investigators, "I thought, oh, F word. I don't want this girl to pass me anything. I better check," according to board records. A third violation of patient privacy allegedly occurred on January 18th of 2022 when Hernandez Roman, then working in St. Luke's Emergency Department, sent a photo of a patient's prolapsed bowel along with unprofessional commentary to a woman he was dating, according to board records. Hernandez Roman allegedly told an investigator he had shared the photo with others because he was competing in a Puerto Rico Sexiest Doctor of the Year contest and wanted to prove he was a physician, according to board records. At that point, UIHC terminated Hernandez-Roman's participation in its emergency medicine residency program for violations of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, gross unsatisfactory performance, and recurring issues with a lack of professionalism. Last year, amid a Board of Medicine investigation into his actions, Hernandez-Roman allegedly blamed his unprofessional behavior and poor judgment on cultural and language barriers, as well as his poor mental health. After a recent hearing on the matter, the board rejected that argument and stated that Hernandez-Roman had exhibited a pattern of unprofessional and dishonest behavior and communication over the very short period of time he had been practicing the profession. The board went on to say his pattern of dishonesty and refusal to follow policies and guidelines related to patient safety indicated he failed to meet the minimum standards of practice and care that are expected of a physician. With regard to the patient privacy violations, the board found that his conduct was particularly disturbing and that he used his status and privilege as a physician to gain private information about individuals with whom he engaged in romantic or sexual relationships. The board finds his justification for his behavior to be blatantly untruthful.
Jose Mendiola of the Des Moines Register submitted this story. A man has been sentenced to 10 years in prison in connection with assaulting a Des Moines police officer and a Polk County jail officer in January. Court documents show a judge handed down the sentence for Demetrius Bloch, B-L-O-C-H, 33, on April 17th. Bloch pleaded guilty to harassment in the first degree and two counts of willful injury causing bodily injury. He was ordered to pay an undisclosed amount to the victims, according to court documents. Bloch was alleged to have attacked Des Moines officer Steve Walters on January 10th while being arrested in connection with a threat to kill employees of a downtown Des Moines business. Des Moines police spokesperson Paul Parisik said Bloch violently headbutted Walters, who court documents said suffered a bloody nose, swelling to his head, dizziness, memory loss, and the loss of hearing in his left ear. A day later, Bloch assaulted another officer in the Polk County Jail, according to court documents, causing a laceration above his left eyebrow. The officer, identified only as Jay Bradley, had to be sent to a hospital for medical treatment, according to court documents. And another short little article here to take us up to the top of the hour. Portugal's government rejects paying reparations for slavery. The dateline is Lisbon, Portugal. Portugal's government said on Saturday it refuses to initiate any process to pay reparations for atrocities committed during transatlantic slavery and the colonial era, contrary to earlier comments from the president of the country. From the 15th to the 19th century, 6 million Africans were kidnapped and forcibly transported across the Atlantic by Portuguese vessels and sold into slavery. Rebelo de Sousa said on Saturday Portugal could use several methods to pay reparations, the government said in a statement sent to the Portuguese news agency Lusa. It wants to, quote, deepen mutual relations, respect for historical truth, and increasingly intense and close cooperation based on the reconciliation of brotherly peoples.